Rom 120, and his love for humanity. It is destined to be recapitulated in Christ at the end of time. Cf. F 1 9-10, Kernel 1 19-20, Facet 2 is a vocation 115. Nature is at our disposal not as a heap of scattered refuse 116, but as a gift of the Creator, who has given it an inbuilt order, enabling man to draw from it the principles needed in order to till it and keep it. General 215. But it should also be stressed that it is contrary to authentic development to view nature as something more important than the human person. This position leads to attitudes of neo-paganism, or in new pantheism, human salvation cannot come from nature alone, understood in a purely naturalistic sense. This having been said, it is also necessary to reject the opposite position, which aims at total technical dominion over nature, because the natural environment is more than raw material, to be manipulated at our pleasure. It is a wondrous work of the Creator containing a grammar which sets forth ends and criteria for its wise use, not its reckless exploitation. Today much harm is done to development precisely as a result of these distorted notions. Reducing nature merely to a collection of contingent data ends up doing violence to the environment, and even encouraging activity that fails to respect human nature itself. Our nature, constituted not only by matter, but also by spirit, and as such, endowed with transcendent meaning and aspirations, is also normative for culture. Human beings interpret and shape the natural environment through culture, which in turn is given direction by the responsible use of freedom, in accordance with the dictates of the moral law. Consequently, projects for integral human development cannot ignore coming generations, but need to be marked by solidarity and intergenerational justice, while taking into account a variety of contexts, ecological, juridical, economic, political, and cultural. 117. 49. Questions linked to the care and preservation of the environment today need to give due consideration to the energy problem. The fact that some states, power groups, and companies hoard non-renewable energy resources represents a grave obstacle to development in poor countries. Those countries lack the economic means either to gain access to existing sources of non-renewable energy, or to finance research into new alternatives. The stockpiling of natural resources, which in many cases are found in the poor countries themselves, gives rise to exploitation and frequent conflicts between and within nations. These conflicts are often fought on the soil of those same countries, with a heavy toll of death, destruction, and further decay. The international community has an urgent duty to find institutional means of regulating the exploitation of non-renewable resources involving poor countries in the process, in order to plan together for the future. On this front too, there is a pressing moral need for renewed solidarity, especially in relationships between developing countries and those that are highly industrialized. 118. The technologically advanced societies can and must lower their domestic energy consumption, either through an evolution in manufacturing methods or through greater ecological sensitivity among their citizens. It should be added that at present it is possible to achieve improved energy efficiency while at the same time encouraging research into alternative forms of energy. What is also needed, though, is a worldwide redistribution of energy resources so that countries lacking those resources can have access to them. The fate of those countries cannot be left in the hands of whoever is first to claim the spoils or whoever is able to prevail over the rest. Here we are dealing with major issues. If they are to be faced adequately, then everyone must responsibly recognize the impact they will have on future generations, particularly on the many young people in the poorer nations who ask to assume their active part in the construction of a better world. 119. 50. This responsibility is a global one, for it is concerned not just with energy, but with the whole of creation, which must not be bequeathed to future generations depleted of its resources. human beings legitimately exercise a responsible stewardship over nature in order to protect it, to enjoy its fruits, and to cultivate it in new ways, with the assistance of advanced technologies, so that it can worthily accommodate and feed the world's population. On this earth there is room for everyone. Here the entire human family must find the resources to live with dignity, through the help of nature itself, God's gift to His children, and through hard work and creativity. At the same time we must recognize our grave duty to hand the earth on to future generations in such a condition that they too can worthily inhabit it and continue to cultivate it. This means being committed to making joint decisions after pondering responsibly the road to be taken, decisions aimed at strengthening that covenant between human beings and the environment, which should mirror the creative love of God, from whom we come and towards whom we are journeying. 120. Let us hope that the international community and individual governments will succeed in countering harmful ways of treating the environment. It is likewise incumbent upon the competent authorities to make every effort to ensure that the economic and social costs of using up shared environmental resources are recognized with transparency and fully borne by those who incur them, not by other peoples or future generations. The protection of the environment, of resources, and of the climate obliges all international leaders to act jointly and to show a readiness to work in good faith, respecting the law, and promoting solidarity with the weakest regions of the planet. 121. One of the greatest challenges facing the economy is to achieve the most efficient use, not abuse, of natural resources, based on a realization that the notion of efficiency is not value-free. 51. The way humanity treats the environment influences the way it treats itself, and vice versa. This invites contemporary society to a serious review of its lifestyle, which, in many parts of the world, is prone to hedonism and consumerism, regardless of their harmful consequences. 122. What is needed is an effective shift in mentality which can lead to the adoption of new lifestyles, in which the quest for truth, beauty, goodness, and communion with others for the sake of common growth are the factors which determine consumer choices, savings, and investments. 123. Every violation of solidarity and civic friendship harms the environment, just as environmental deterioration in turn upsets relations in society. Nature, especially in our time, is so integrated into the dynamics of society and culture that by now it hardly constitutes an independent variable. Desertification and the decline in productivity in some agricultural areas are also the result of impoverishment and underdevelopment among their inhabitants. When incentives are offered for their economic and cultural development, nature itself is protected. Moreover, how many natural resources are squandered by wars? Peace in and among peoples would also provide greater protection for nature. The hoarding of resources, especially water, can generate serious conflicts among the peoples involved. Peaceful agreement about the use of resources can protect nature and, at the same time, the well-being of the societies concerned. The Church has a responsibility towards creation, and she must assert this responsibility in the public sphere. In so doing, she must defend not only earth, water, and air as gifts of creation that belong to everyone. She must above all protect mankind from self-destruction. There is need for what might be called a human ecology, correctly understood. The deterioration of nature is in fact closely connected to the culture that shapes human coexistence. When human ecology 124 is respected within society, environmental ecology also benefits. Just as human virtues are interrelated, such that the weakening of one places others at risk, so the ecological system is based on respect for a plan that affects both the health of society and its good relationship with nature. In order to protect nature, it is not enough to intervene with economic incentives or deterrents, not even an apposite education is sufficient. These are important steps, but the decisive issue is the overall moral tenor of society. If there is a lack of respect for the right to life and to a natural death, if human conception, gestation, and birth are made artificial, If human embryos are sacrificed to research, the conscience of society ends up losing the concept of human ecology, and, along with it, that of environmental ecology. It is contradictory to insist that future generations respect the natural environment, when our educational systems and laws do not help them to respect themselves. The book of nature is one and indivisible. It takes in not only the environment, but also life, sexuality, marriage, the family, social relations, in a word, integral human development. Our duties towards the environment are linked to our duties towards the human person, considered in himself and in relation to others. It would be wrong to uphold one set of duties while trampling on the other. Herein lies a grave contradiction in our mentality and practice today, one which demeans the person, disrupts the environment, and damages society. 52. Truth and the love which it reveals cannot be produced, they can only be received as a gift. Their ultimate source is not, and cannot be, mankind, but only God, who is himself truth and love. This principle is extremely important for society and for development, since neither can be a purely human product. The vocation to development on the part of individuals and peoples is not based simply on human choice, but is an intrinsic part of a plan that is prior to us and constitutes for all of us a duty to be freely accepted. That which is prior to us and constitutes us, subsistent love and truth, shows us what goodness is and in what our true happiness consists. It shows us the road to true development. Chapter 5. The Cooperation of the Human Family. 53. One of the deepest forms of poverty a person can experience is isolation. If we look closely at other kinds of poverty, including material forms, we see that they are born from isolation, from not being loved, or from difficulties in being able to love. Poverty is often produced by a rejection of God's love, by man's basic and tragic tendency to close in on himself, thinking himself to be self-sufficient, or merely an insignificant and ephemeral fact, a stranger in a random universe. Man is alienated when he is alone, when he is detached from reality, when he stops thinking and believing in a foundation. 125. All of humanity is alienated when too much trust is placed in merely human projects, ideologies, and false utopias. 126. Today humanity appears much more interactive than in the past. This shared sense of being close to one another must be transformed into true communion. The development of peoples depends, above all, on a recognition that the human race is a single family working together in true communion, not simply a group of subjects who happen to live side by side. 127. Pope Paul VI noted that the world is in trouble because of the lack of thinking. 128. He was making an observation, but also expressing a wish. A new trajectory of thinking is needed in order to arrive at a better understanding of the implications of our being one family. Interaction among the peoples of the world calls us to embark upon this new trajectory, so that integration can signify solidarity. 129, rather than marginalization. Thinking of this kind requires a deeper critical evaluation of the category of relation. This is a task that cannot be undertaken by the social sciences alone, insofar as the contribution of disciplines such as metaphysics and theology is needed if man's transcendent dignity is to be properly understood. As a spiritual being, the human creature is defined through interpersonal relations. The more authentically he or she lives these relations, the more his or her own personal identity matures. It is not by isolation that man establishes his worth, but by placing himself in relation with others and with God. Hence these relations take on fundamental importance. The same holds true for peoples as well. A metaphysical understanding of the relations between persons is therefore of great benefit for their development. In this regard, reason finds inspiration and direction in Christian revelation, according to which the human community does not absorb the individual, annihilating his autonomy, as happens in the various forms of totalitarianism, but rather values him all the more because the relation between individual and community is a relation between one totality and another 130. Just as a family does not submerge the identities of its individual members, just as the Church rejoices in each new creation, Gal 6:15, 2 Cor 5:17, incorporated by baptism into her living body, so too the unity of the human family does not submerge the identities of individuals, peoples, and cultures, but makes them more transparent to each other and links them more closely in their legitimate diversity. 54. The theme of development can be identified with the inclusion in relation of all individuals and peoples within the one community of the human family, built in solidarity on the basis of the fundamental values of justice and peace. This perspective is illuminated in a striking way by the relationship between the persons of the Trinity within the one divine substance. The Trinity is absolute unity insofar as the three divine persons are pure relationality. The reciprocal transparency among the divine persons is total, and the bond between each of them complete, since they constitute a unique and absolute unity. God desires to incorporate us into this reality of communion, as well, that they may be one even, as we are one, John 17:22. The Church is a sign and instrument of this unity, 131. Relationships between human beings throughout history cannot but be enriched by reference to this divine model. In particular, in the light of the revealed mystery of the Trinity, we understand that true openness does not mean loss of individual identity, but profound interpenetration. This also emerges from the common human experiences of love and truth. Just as the sacramental love of spouses unites them spiritually in one flesh, General 2:24. Mount 19:5, F531, and makes out of the two a real and relational unity, so in an analogous way truth unites spirits, and causes them to think in unison, attracting them, as a unity to itself. 55. The Christian revelation of the unity of the human race presupposes a metaphysical interpretation of the humanum in which relationality is an essential element. Other cultures and religions teach brotherhood and peace, and are therefore of enormous importance to integral human development. Some religious and cultural attitudes, however, do not fully embrace the principle of love and truth, and therefore end up retarding or even obstructing authentic human development. There are certain religious cultures in the world today that do not oblige men and women to live in communion, but rather cut them off from one another in a search for individual well-being, limited to the gratification of psychological desires. Furthermore, a certain proliferation of different religious paths attracting small groups, or even single individuals, together with religious syncretism, can give rise to separation and disengagement. One possible negative effect of the process of globalization is the tendency to favor this kind of syncretism, 132, by encouraging forms of religion that, instead of bringing in people together, alienate them from one another and distance them from reality. At the same time, some religious and cultural traditions persist which ossify society in rigid social groupings, in magical beliefs that fail to respect the dignity of the person, and in attitudes of subjugation to occult powers. In these contexts, love and truth have difficulty asserting themselves, and authentic development is impeded. For this reason, while it may be true that development needs the religions and cultures of different peoples, it is equally true that adequate discernment is needed. Religious freedom does not mean religious indifferentism, nor does it imply that all religions are equal, 133. Discernment is needed regarding the contribution of cultures and religions, especially on the part of those who wield political power, if the social community is to be built up in a spirit of respect for the common good. Such discernment has to be based on the criterion of charity and truth. Since the development of persons and peoples is at stake, this discernment will have to take account of the need for emancipation and inclusivity in the context of a truly universal human community. The whole man and all men is also the criterion for evaluating cultures and religions. Christianity, the religion of the God, who has a human face, 134, contains this very criterion within itself. 56. The Christian religion and other religions can offer their contribution to development only if God has a place in the public realm, specifically in regard to its cultural, social, economic, and particularly its political dimensions. The Church's social doctrine came into being in order to claim citizenship status for the Christian religion 135, denying the right to profess one's religion in public, and the right to bring the truths of faith to bear upon public life has negative consequences for true development, the exclusion of religion from the public square, and, at the other extreme, religious fundamentalism, hinders an encounter between persons and their collaboration for the progress of humanity. Public life is sapped of its motivation and politics takes on a domineering and aggressive character. Human rights risk being ignored, either because they are robbed of their transcendent foundation, or because personal freedom is not acknowledged. Secularism and fundamentalism exclude the possibility of fruitful dialogue and effective cooperation between reason and religious faith. Reason always stands in need of being purified by faith. This also holds true for political reason, which must not consider itself omnipotent. For its part, religion always needs to be purified by reason in order to show its authentically human face. Any breach in this dialogue comes only at an enormous price to human development. 57. Fruitful dialogue between faith and reason cannot but render the work of charity more effective within society, and it constitutes the most appropriate framework for promoting fraternal collaboration between believers and non-believers in their shared commitment to working for justice and the peace of the human family. In the Pastoral Constitution Gaudium et Spes, the Council Fathers asserted that believers and unbelievers agree almost unanimously that all things on earth should be ordered towards man, as to their center and summit 136. For believers, the world derives neither from blind chance nor from strict necessity, but from God's plan. This is what gives rise to the duty of believers to unite their efforts with those of all men and women of goodwill, with the followers of other religions, and with non-believers, so that this world of ours may effectively correspond to the divine plan, living, as a family, under the Creator's watchful eye, a particular manifestation of charity, and a guiding criterion for fraternal cooperation between believers and non-believers is undoubtedly the principle of subsidiarity 137, an expression of inalienable human freedom. Subsidiarity is first and foremost a form of assistance to the human person via the autonomy of intermediate bodies. Such assistance is offered when individuals or groups are unable to accomplish something on their own, and it is always designed to achieve their emancipation, because it fosters freedom and participation through assumption of responsibility. Subsidiarity respects personal dignity by recognizing in the person a subject who is always capable of giving something to others. By considering reciprocity as the heart of what it is to be a human being, subsidiarity is the most effective antidote against any form of all-encompassing welfare state. It is able to take account both of the manifold articulation of plans, and therefore of the plurality of subjects, as well as the coordination of those plans. Hence the principle of subsidiarity is particularly well suited to managing globalization and directing it towards authentic human development. In order not to produce a dangerous universal power of a tyrannical nature, the governance of globalization must be marked by subsidiarity, articulated in two several layers and involving different levels that can work together. Globalization certainly requires authority, insofar as it poses the problem of a global common good that needs to be pursued. This authority, however, must be organized in a subsidiary and stratified way 138, if it is not to infringe upon freedom, and if it is to yield effective results in practice. 58. The principle of subsidiarity must remain closely linked to the principle of solidarity, and vice versa, since the former without the latter gives way to social privatism, while the latter, without the former, gives way to paternalist social assistance that is demeaning to those in need. This general rule must also be taken broadly into consideration when addressing issues concerning international development aid. Such aid, whatever the donor's intentions, can sometimes lock people into a state of dependence and even foster situations of localized oppression and exploitation in the receiving country. Economic aid, in order to be true to its purpose, must not pursue secondary objectives. It must be distributed with the involvement not only of the governments of receiving countries, but also local economic agents and the bearers of culture within civil society, including local churches. Aid programs must increasingly acquire the characteristics of participation and completion from the grassroots. Indeed, the most valuable resources in countries receiving development aid are human resources. Herein lies the real capital that needs to accumulate in order to guarantee a truly autonomous future for the poorest countries. It should also be remembered that, in the economic sphere, the principal form of assistance needed by developing countries is that of allowing and encouraging the gradual penetration of their products into international markets, thus making it possible for these countries to participate fully in international economic life. Too often in the past, aid has served to create only fringe markets for the products of these donor countries. This was often due to a lack of genuine demand for the products in question. It is therefore necessary to help such countries improve their products and adapt them more effectively to existing demand. Furthermore, there are those who fear the effects of competition through the importation of products, normally agricultural products, from economically poor countries. Nevertheless, it should be remembered that for such countries, the possibility of marketing their products is very often what guarantees their survival, in both the short and long term. Just and equitable international trade in agricultural goods can be beneficial to everyone, both to suppliers and to customers. For this reason, not only is commercial orientation needed for production of this kind, but also the establishment of international trade regulations to support it and stronger financing for development in order to increase the productivity of these economies. 59. Cooperation for development must not be concerned exclusively with the economic dimension. It offers a wonderful opportunity for encounter between cultures and peoples. If the parties to cooperation on the side of economically developed countries, as occasionally happens, fail to take account of their own or others' cultural identity, or the human values that shape it, they cannot enter into meaningful dialogue with the citizens of poor countries. If the latter, in their turn, are uncritically and indiscriminately open to every cultural proposal, they will not be in a position to assume responsibility for their own authentic development. 139. Technologically advanced societies must not confuse their own technological development with a presumed cultural superiority, but must rather rediscover within themselves the oft-forgotten virtues which made it possible for them to flourish throughout their history. Evolving societies must remain faithful to all that is truly human in their traditions, avoiding the temptation to overlay them automatically with the mechanisms of a globalized technological civilization. In all cultures there are examples of ethical convergence, some isolated, some interrelated, as an expression of the one human nature, willed by the Creator. The tradition of ethical wisdom knows this, as the natural law 140. This universal moral law provides a sound basis for all cultural, religious, and political dialogue, and it ensures that the multifaceted pluralism of cultural diversity does not detach itself from the common quest for truth, goodness, and God. Thus, adherence to the law etched on human hearts is the precondition for all constructive social cooperation. Every culture has burdens from which it must be freed and shadows from which it must emerge. The Christian faith, by becoming incarnate in cultures, and at the same time transcending them, can help them grow in universal brotherhood and solidarity for the advancement of global and community development. 60. In the search for solutions to the current economic crisis, development aid for poor countries must be considered a valid means of creating wealth for all. What aid program is there that can hold out such significant growth prospects, even from the point of view of the world economy, as the support of populations that are still in the initial or early phases of economic development? From this perspective, more economically developed nations should do all they can to allocate larger portions of their gross domestic product to development aid, thus respecting the obligations that the international community has undertaken in this regard. One way of doing so is by reviewing their internal social assistance and welfare policies, applying the principle of subsidiarity, and creating better integrated welfare systems, with the active participation of private individuals and civil society.